This is HPR episode 2269 entitled, Chocolate Milk. It is hosted by first-time host Venom, and is about 42 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, a sample show of the Nixon podcast, Adam's Story, Milky Chocolate, Unicomp, and Plan 9.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
With Adam about three things, Unicomp, Plan 9, and chocolate milk. The emphasis of the discussion is on Plan 9, an operating system that intrigues many in the Unix realm. Plan 9 has a deep two-way relation or connection with Unix, both as being inspired by it and by inspiring it. And we also took the liberty to discuss other topics for the leisure and enjoyment of the listener. And I was surprised by how composed, calm, and serious Adam was. From my small previous encounter with him, I thought he would be different, but my assumptions were wrong. Don't judge others. He knows his subjects to the core and is truly passionate about them. I've learned quite a lot during this podcast, and here we go. I'm Venom, in the company of Adam/APK, and you're listening to The Nixers Podcast. So, who's this Adam/APK guy?
Which one you prefer, Adam or APK?
Adam, I guess. You know, I don't really have any preference, but Adam's my name, so...
Why do you switch to APK instead of Adam?
I don't know. I got bored, and I think APK is, like, a bit more Unix-y, you know? Like, Dennis Ritchie used DMR, and then... Well, I guess Ken used Ken, but that's because it's three letters. I don't know. I got bored of Adam, so I chose.
He's an infamous or famous forums member that is quite eccentric. He's most noticeable for his true love of Unicomp and Plan 9. And one day on IRC, he even went on Howard's epic storytelling of the Plan 9 history. And you can find the story log in the show notes if it interests you. Let's start with Unicomp, which is a mechanical keyboard. And for those who don't know, mechanical keyboards are popular in the computing world in general, and especially with Unix users, as they tend to have more textual interface and spend most of their time typing. There's also a lot of keyboard layouts and keyboards where they remove many keys, 10 key less, 10% less.
Yeah, how about the Unicomp first? I think the Unicomp's an easy one to talk about. And not just the Unicomp per se, but what I did with the Unicomp, I guess. So,
from my knowledge, the Unicomp is like this not so old company, but like in the 90s, and they have this infamous IBM Model M where it has this sort of buckling string.
Right.
Where it's a sort of tube inside, and you have the spring doing a sort of clicky sound. It's sort of like different than the Cherry MX series. So how would you compare it to the Cherry MX, and what do you have to say about that Unicomp?
Yeah, you got it pretty well. The Unicomp is like the mechanical, well, not necessarily the Unicomp, but the buckling spring is like the mechanical, right? It's super loud, super clacky. It uses like an actual metal spring in all the keys, you know, hence the name. And the cherry keys, the cherry switches are a little bit more sophisticated. They're designed specifically for a certain type of tactile response and audio, like, you know, audible feedback, while the buckling spring is sort of this like raw key switch that was like used way back in the day. And so the Unicomp is sort of like an emulation of the Model M, the IBM Model M, which is a legendary mechanical keyboard in the community.
So it does feel that amazing, that phenomenal when you click it. Mm. Or, I mean, you have other mechanical keyboards. How would you compare the feel?
Yeah.
Is it like between red and blue, or between transparent or white keycaps? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I would probably, if we're talking about like comparison between cherry and the buckling spring, I'd have to go with green switches. Cherry have green switches, which are, I think if I remember correctly, the green switch is the loudest switch that Cherry manufactures, and it's also the one that requires the most force to get to the actuation point. Because the buckling spring, I mean, you gotta have, it takes some strength, it takes some stamina to use the buckling spring board. It's not easy to push down on. It's not quiet. So the Cherry MX Green, and I actually have a green board.
Do you feel like you're splitting in half the spring or something? Like it's a very hard pressure, I don't know.
So the way it works inside is the spring gets pressed. It's a spring, so it gets compacted down, and then it kind of works a little bit like a cherry. And then there's a little piece of plastic with like a hook on it or so. And I guess it's more like two now I think about it, in the buckling spring. And so the spring gets pushed down, kind of, you know, tilted a bit depending on the key switch, like the letters and the numbers are smaller than the space bar and whatnot, and so they'll sound a bit different. But in general, it does take a lot of strength to push down. I mean, it's just a key switch; it doesn't take like noticeable strength. But if you're doing like rubber dome typing and you switch to a buckling spring, you're going to notice some serious difference in actuation point and audio feedback and like that.
Do they still manufacture them?
Oh, yeah. The Unicomp, I mean, the whole point, I think, behind the Unicomp is just sort of like the revival of the buckling spring keyboard, you know, because they're kind of hard to come across these days. If you're finding a buckling spring that's not a Unicomp, it's probably some like old 30-year-old IBM, you know, bulky board from the 80s or so. So I got it on sale actually a while ago. It was about $100 or so. Pretty expensive, but most of them are.
Well, $100 is not that expensive for a mechanical keyboard.
Yeah,
I think you would agree.
I would agree with that. I would, but I think, you know, a lot of people, like when they first get into mechanical keyboards, they see the price tags on some of them and they just kind of like their jaws drop, you know, like how could a keyboard be this much?
Compared to the cheap ones you have on the, or any
right,
big one.
Right. Yeah, the OEM, like HP Dell keyboards, which are like, you know, $20 or so. And I think you remember very well what I did as a result of purchasing that keyboard. I was spamming the forums about it.
You did.
Yeah.
But I did leave like two threads on the forum because you were happy with them, I think.
Right, yeah. I did dedicate a few threads just for the Unicomp. If I remember correctly, that resulted in me getting banned for like a week or so by you, because all I do is just post stupid shit all over the forum. But yeah, I love Unicomp, man. It's a good keyboard.
Okay, so now back on the Unix topic. Does it have any relation here, the sort of IBM Model M, mm-hmm. with Unix directly? Like, was it used on PDP 1? I think not, because it's too new.
Yeah, that's not that old. It was probably more towards the 80s. So during the time where glass terminals were the norm. And of course, in the 80s, we did see, you know, the start of monochrome displays and even color displays in the mid-80s. The IBM model piece, my IBM Model M, I don't have a lot of knowledge on it myself. It was seemed to be fairly standard with like high-end computer users, you know, people who did computing for a living. Although back in the 80s, you know, back in that day when you had, you know, like serial ports and you had the terminal connecting to a mainframe, you had really the terminal was sort of like connected to the keyboard, you know, in most cases, like a lot of DEC terminals and things like that, the terminal and the keyboard were kind of all one big unit, you know. And then when the personal computer came along, that's when you saw like the keyboard being split up with the monitor, and then you have the actual computer, you know, a mouse, depending on what computer you got.
I think it did make sense to have it in one unit because the terminal was the end point of the CPU, because the CPU was somewhere else. It was the processing unit somewhere else, and you just had the thin client, the end output. And then came the personal computer with peripherals, and right. you can plug stuff around. And then it came to be unplugged from the main machine.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, you have anything to add for the Unicomp? Obviously, you have praises and...
Oh, yes. It's a good keyboard. Yeah, if you can get your hands on one, even if you can just like touch one, just give it a shot, because buckling springs are a different beast compared to this cherry switches and Alps and Topers and whatnot.
That was a deep, passionate view on Unicomp keyboards. So Unicomp are really distinct by the buckling string and historically go along with the professional computing on terminals and the advent of personal computing. They have their place more or less in the Unix history. Now let's touch another topic that surrounds and embraces Unix, Plan 9. Let's go for the discussion with our favorite Plan 9 expert.
Let's move on to your favorite topic, Plan 9.
Plan 9.
Okay, so I don't know that much about Plan 9. I did my research this week, and I did try it a bit on a friend's machine, a virtual machine, not really full install on the hardware itself, because from what I know, it doesn't have really that big of a support for hardware.
Right.
Anyway, from what I know, it was made by the same people that were working on Unix. It was inspired by Unix, but it's not Unix. It's just inspired by it. So it's done from scratch, totally from scratch, with ideas from the people who were working on Unix.
Right.
For 20 years working on Unix and then using those operating system knowledge to build something completely new. They took those ideas and still integrated some tools that are Unix-like, but they redid them from scratch. They took the concept of pipe over and over again. There is no root. There's per process namespace, per user access. There's something. There's total integration with the network and a lot of cool stuff like Unicode.
Yeah,
and it has a built-in graphical environment, etc., etc. So that's really a big generic overview of the thing, and I'm not really knowledgeable about the little details.
Mm-hmm.
But what would be like for someone who knows Linux or BSD or Solaris or the newest kind of Unix, what would be your definition, like in two sentences or one sentence, about Plan 9? Like, you would explain to them what's Plan 9?
If I had to describe Plan 9 in one sentence or a couple sentences, I would say, first, I would say everything's a file. Like, everything is a file. Everything is a file. If you think, like, it's not a file, you're probably wrong. And the second thing would be, it is the true successor to Unix. Nowadays, you know, it's probably the most obscure thing out there, operating system-wise. But, you know, historically speaking, it was the successor to Unix. It was supposed to be, for all intents and purposes, Unix version 2.0. So, yeah, I have to summarize it with those two sentences. Everything's a file, and it's the true successor to Unix.
Okay, let's dig on that point that everything is a file. From what I know, they have something that is called a union directories and namespace. And they don't have really a difference between local machine and remote machines.
Right.
How does that happen? What do you know on that level? Did you try it? Did you do a network or you just, what do you know about it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. A couple of years ago, I actually managed to get a small cluster of Plan 9 machines working. I had about three or four Lenovo ThinkCenters. They're like really small desktop PCs. I networked them all using Ethernet. I installed the base distribution of Plan 9, the one that came out of Bell Labs. I installed it on all of those. And I wasn't really trying to like do anything practical with it. You know, I was just trying to learn how to network the machines together, because it was built. The system was built to be used on not just one machine, but multiple machines over a network. And so what I did was I assigned different roles to different servers. And in Plan 9, there's like, if I remember correctly, I think there's three different types of servers you can have. No, I guess four technically. You have a CPU server, which does a lot of like the computation and processing. You have an authentication server, which authenticates the users and services on the cluster. You have your kind of like hard drive storage server, which like has bulk hard drive space. And then you finally have all your terminals, your small thin clients connecting to those machines. And the system was designed in a way that would allow the user to access all the resources from the CPU server and the hard drive server, the storage server and authentication server. And they presented to them in a way that made it seem like all those resources were on the same machine. And that was multiplexed to all the terminals on the network. So every single user would have the same kind of resource pool to pull from. So I did that with about three or four Lenovo ThinkCenters. It was a pretty, crappy design on my part because the computers are bad, but I did get to like get my hands dirty with it and whatnot. It was pretty cool. Yeah, so from
that's
high
impressive.
Level. Yeah, from a high level, that's the networking part of it, yeah.
Okay, so you said there's this, you can assign to a machine like the CPU role, the storage role, etc.
Yeah.
From what I know, there's no root user on Plan 9. It's
right.
Completely renewed the concept of access control.
Mm-hmm.
They use a communication protocol called 9P instead of BSD sockets or
mm-hmm.
sockets.
Mm-hmm.
So does this have a relation with, like inside the 9P protocol, they have authentication to know which one should access? How does the access control really happen? The only way to communicate between stuff is with the 9P protocol, and you don't have any root user.
Right.
So there should be some authentication inside the packets or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so 9P, I call it, this might be its like technical definition, but this is what I call it. I call it a ubiquitous network transparent protocol, which is to say that it's a protocol that's used practically everywhere in the system, from authentication to connecting to services to accessing resources. And it's network transparent in that it can use, TCP, it can use UDP, it can use application layer protocols. It can use all these different things, but it's still uses the same interface. So when you use 9P, you could be using it with a server around somewhere across the world, or it could be in the same building, or it could be the same machine. 9P doesn't really care that much, it's just, it's designed to be transparent in that regard. So on the topic of authentication and the absence of a root user, there is an account, I think it's called the host owner, which is given on every machine. So the CPU server will have a host owner, and the storage server will have a host owner, and if anything else, it'll have a host owner. And it's not necessarily a root account, it's host owner, but it's an account that's really used for maintenance stuff. You can use the host owner to add hardware devices, upgrading hardware. You can use it to manage some services on the system. Because when you're in a network where there's no like administrator user, you're still going to need to use some kind of privileged account to do some certain tasks. That's just kind of something you can't avoid. But with that said, the host owner account is still pretty limited in its privileges. Bell Labs did do a pretty good job of making the system work really well without a root account. And authentication-wise, it's a tough subject to talk about, in my opinion. Authentication on Plan 9 is really a exotic thing. And in fact, they didn't actually implement a robust authentication process until about like the fourth edition or so. They wrote this thing called Factotum, which is the for all intents and purposes, it's the authentication protocol for the system. And Factotum uses a really interesting design. And the way it works just kind of fascinates me. I haven't used it as much as I'd like to. I remember a few months ago, I hosted a nine front server. Nine front's a fork of Plan 9, a derivative of Plan 9. I ran it on a virtual private server, and a bunch of Nixers guys connected to it, and they messed around with it. And that was kind of my dive into Factotum, because I needed to use Factotum to authenticate everybody. In the case where I had my small cluster of ThinkCenters, I was the only person using it, so authentication was not really a priority for me. But with the VPS running 9front, when I had multiple people, that's where Factotum came into play. And that's where I really got to understand, at least from an interface perspective, how it works and what it is. So generally speaking, authentication in Plan 9 wasn't really a primary goal until later on. And in fact, Totem is really a fascinating piece of software. It's confusing, but it's pretty cool, yeah.
So talking about those exotic things,
mm-hmm.
Do you think there's something like that was inspired, like really directly inspired by the Unix, by some Unix tools, but that was like a superset of it? I think it was, they took piping
mm-hmm.
and they made something called Plumber, but Plumber
right.
is pretty new, I think.
Yeah.
So do you think it's a superset of it? Because it's made by the same people.
Yeah, they definitely use some concepts from Research Unix. Plumber is a good example, like you said. So the plumber is an inter-process communication mechanism where you can send text over I guess you can call it a pipe. You send text to the plumber, and depending on what kind of text it is, the plumber could parse it and understand where it needs to go or what you're trying to say with it. Like I could plumb a string of numbers or a string of numbers and characters that follows a certain like regular expression, and a application will open as a result. So I think a good example is Acme. Acme is the one of the Plan 9 text editors written by Rob Pike. So I could send like a string of text from a terminal. It could have like a file name and then a number line, and just plumb that as is. And Plan 9, or I guess the plumber, would be smart enough to know that that's a file that needs to be opened. And so what it would do is it would open up Acme with that file already opened, and it would highlight the line that was inside the string of text that you plumbed to it. So I think that's a good solid example of what the plumber is. And in fact, actually, there were a lot of userland applications that were directly ported to Plan 9. You know, you still have things like cat and LS and PS and some simple programs like that. Some of them were ported directly to Plan 9C, while others were rewritten in RC. And RC is the scripting language used for Plan 9, and is also the shell used for the terminals. So yeah, it's pretty easy to notice some principles used in traditional Unix with Plan 9, which makes a lot of sense, you know, because it came from the same guys. But they definitely revisited a lot of things with Plan 9 in that regard.
So I think I've saw, but I'm not sure of it. I'm really not sure of it, but I think they're using another C dialect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Can you confirm that?
Yes, yeah, they use their own dialect of C, yeah.
Okay, so there's something that I was surprised at first, but Plan 9 is graphic-oriented,
mm-hmm.
And there's a guy called Eric Raymond, I think you know it, from Art of Unix Programming, and he says that one of the things very specific to a Unix system is that it's first based on text, mm-hmm. And then the layer above comes with graphics or whatever fancy overlay you want to add to it.
Right.
But Plan 9 comes like graphical first.
Yeah.
Do you think it was a good choice to go for that? Or because it's made by the same people who did Unix, so probably did it for a good reason.
Yeah. Yeah. And the graphics discussion, I think one thing you need to look at with that is the time period that Plan 9 was developed in. You know, the initial development started in the late 80s time period. So we're looking at like, you know, operating systems like Windows and early versions of Mac OS. Well, I guess in the early 80s, and not the early 80s, late 80s, Windows wasn't a whole OS. It was just a program for DOS. But anyways, so we had graphical user interfaces coming to home PCs, personal PCs. We also saw networking take a huge influence over that. So yeah, I think they were correct in making graphics a integral part of the system, you know. And sometimes really need to be said about the Unix guys, you know, basically taking a stance on graphics and kind of showing the world what they think they should be, because they did a pretty good job. I mean, the interface to Plan 9 graphics wise is, as usual, exotic, because Plan 9 is just a very strange operating system, bluntly put. The way they did graphics in comparison to operating systems like Mac OS and Windows, and even Unix desktops like CDE and X11 window managers like TWM and whatnot, the way Plan 9 did it was just so much more simple, in my opinion. Not just from an interface standpoint, like the user interface, but also the software used to show that graphical experience was really quite a feat. Eight and a half was initially written for Unix by Rob Pike, and then they kind of worked on that more and wrote Rio, which is the current window manager for Plan 9. But yeah, 8.5 was sort of a precursor to what would be the graphical user interface for Plan 9. And you can see that with photos of 8.5 and Rio. 8.5 was written for monochrome displays. And then once bitmap displays came into the picture, that's when they added color, and Rio had support for that and a few other things as well. But yeah, 8.5 was a precursor to the interface.
I think the novelty behind it comes from the fact that Rob Pike did write the graphical environment, the mm-hmm. graphical server before X11 and before any of the big like graphical environment was still something new. So he wasn't biased. He wasn't copying something else. He did his own thing, his own concept.
Yeah. Yeah. He, in the early 80s, 1982 or so, he created the Blit terminal, which used a graphical interface. And even that from 1982 and Plan 9 development didn't start until 6 or 7 years after 82. You still see with the Blit terminal, you can still see Plan 9 in it. It was used on Unix, obviously. But yeah, Rob Pike, he had that idea for a long time, that whole user interface.
Let's move to a section like how Plan 9 affected other operating system, how what it did really inspired others.
Mm-hmm.
So, or how it did take it to another step. Like, for example, the minimalism philosophy.
Yeah.
Without Unix, just minimalism itself. Instead of having like other operating systems and the thousands of system calls, Plan 9 has only 51 system calls.
Right, yeah.
Which is really impressive. When I did the research on system calls for one of the podcasts, I was reading them and like for Plan 9, it's just headers and numbers and that's it.
Yeah.
That's about minimalism. But there are stuff like really other operating system completely copied and took from Plan 9 itself.
Definitely.
Like the / proc directory.
Right.
The union file system and sort of like Docker, the software Docker, like you do. UTF-8 itself, it's a standard nowadays. Network file systems too. Anyway, what do you have to say about like the inspiration for other operating systems? There's someone that says that sooner or later, Plan 9 cannot reach the point where it's going to be popular. But sooner or later, other operating systems are going to try to incorporate some function that Plan 9 already does. So it could somehow get inside or merge with some other operating system.
Yeah. A lot needs to be said in that regard. I think two of the largest things we need to look at with that are UTF-8, like you said, and the proc file system, both of which originated in Plan 9. And in fact, Rob Pike, Ken Thompson created Unicode. Rob Pike was with him. I don't know why I remember this so vivid, like the whole story so vividly, but I do. I think it's pretty cool. Ken Thompson, who worked on the original Unix with Dennis Ritchie in the late 60s and early 70s, Ken was with Rob Pike in a diner, just some random diner somewhere, I think. And Ken managed to write down what Unicode was in the back of like a placemat or a napkin or something. And its design, it was just so sophisticated yet simple. And I think as computer scientists and programmers, you know, we need to follow that kind of philosophy with everything we do. And Plan 9 definitely did that. And so UTF-8 was a lot of things, actually. It was backwards compatible with ASCII, which was a huge deal. Because you didn't have to do anything else. Like if you had a string of ASCII text, ASCII could just be used without any extra effort at all. UTF-8 could use ASCII, and that was that. Another thing was it used the stream was the number of bytes that you could use for a character was arbitrary, which means that you didn't have a fixed number of bytes to work with. So when you're sending bytes over the wire, over a network, UTF-8 was able to know how many bytes it was expecting for a certain character, and then read those bytes as they were. And so when you're dealing with a lot of languages, that's a big deal because, you know, you have different sections of bytes for different languages, and then actually different sections of bits as well, actually. So for UTF-8 to be able to do that at the time was pretty impressive. Nowadays, we kind of take that kind of thing for granted, but when you had when networking was a little bit more expensive back in those days, being able to know exactly what you're expecting as it's going over the wire was pretty cool. And so UTF-8 was quite an accomplishment on their part. To go on with that a little bit more, the time period as well. When you're dealing with a lot of locales like ASCII or ISO 8859 or, you know, some Japanese or French or German, whatever it might be, whatever language it might be, having an encoding that's capable of expressing tons of languages and even have enough room to show, like, you know, emoticons and, you know, things like that is amazing. Because you could have files that are in UTF-8, you know, they can express different languages effortlessly, right? If you're doing like encoding A to encoding B, you might get a lot of weird symbols and stuff because the encodings are different. But if you have a standard encoding for all languages, that's good because the file could be in that encoding, applications can use that, and we're all kind of on the same page in that regard. And so UTF-8 was great, and that was obviously taken by other operating systems, and the web as well uses a lot. You know, Unicode's huge on the web, and then the proc file system, kind of changing subjects, that originated out of Plan 9, and the proc file system exposes processes at a file system level, you know, hence the name. So you can view things
for IPC.
Oh. Right, yeah. You can use it for IPC. Yeah, and you can use it. I think another good use of it is debugging as well, debugging applications. But being able to view, you know, the memory it's using, what it's accessing, things like that are pretty cool. And proc is used directly in Linux and some of the BSDs. I don't think OpenBSD uses it, but I think FreeBSD uses
FreeBSD,
it.
FreeBSD, yeah.
Yeah. And so the proc file system is pretty cool, yeah. Yeah, the proc file system is pretty cool. And I think that relates back to everything as a file. On Plan 9, like I said before, everything is a file, you know, to TCP packets, to the mouse, to the keyboard, to the monitor, to other hardware devices, sockets, again, processes. Acme windows are files. It's really cool. And the proc file system is a good example of that everything is a file philosophy that Plan 9 implemented so well. Union mounts, but I think the purpose behind union mounts in Plan 9 was to kind of get rid of environment variables. Specifically path and those related environment variables. So you could have, you know, the slash bin directory, and you could mount other directories on the slash bin, right? So Plan 9, they like to divide their binaries up by architect as well as even in some cases language. So on Plan 9, you might have like slash 386 slash bin, which are all binaries used on 386 machines. And so you can mount that to slash bin and you'd have like 386 binaries. You could have like,
so that binaries are shared also across the network. So you have one machine that's role is only to serve binaries. You can have that.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah, and the reason they made an effort to make sure that like the architecture of binaries was taken note of was because Plan 9 was an operating system that operating system that could be used on several different architectures, right? It's a architecture agnostic kind of system. You could run a Spark binary on a 386. And that would work perfectly fine because of the way it was designed. And you could mount all those binary directories on the slash bin. And you could even use, you can mount them like before or after other directories. So you could like say, if I have two versions of the same program and I want to use a specific one, I could use mount to, you know, put that specific one before the one that might already be mounted or would be mounted later on. And that's used in other places as well. And in fact, mounting in that sense, it's pretty integral to Plan 9. You're always mounting stuff on Plan 9 because in Plan 9, not only is everything a file, but almost everything's a file system as well.
What surprised me on that topic of union file system is that nowadays people are like mesmerized at this concept, mm-hmm. of, especially when it's on distributed computing and containers. And I really, it's a real situation that happened. I had a friend come to me and he was, Yeah. Docker invented union file systems. And then when I heard about Plan 9 and I checked that, I was like, wait a minute. Everyone is so surprised or so fantasizing about containers when in fact distributed computing and union file system, the solution was there all along.
Yeah, it's been here for a while.
So,
yeah.
So yeah. It's really inspiring new software. So,
yeah, union file systems. Well, actually, you brought up Docker. I think a cool comparison to be made with Docker. So Docker, contains you know, programs so you can roll up a Docker container, which could run like a distro or whatever. I don't know much about Docker. I just kind of understand it vaguely. But terminals on Plan 9 are kind of like that, kind of like Docker. They're sort of like containers, you know. So when you open up two terminals, the terminal has its own overview of the network, which is to say it has its own overview of the machine. And so you can mount, you can mount like, I don't know, you can mount, say, a network card from a different machine onto one terminal, and the other terminal would have no idea. So you could not access that card with the other terminal. And so there's sort of a sense of isolation in that regard, which Docker does a good thing, which does this well, does isolation well, because it contains software. So yeah, you could say Docker has, maybe not directly, but definitely indirectly, taken a lot of things from Plan 9.
I don't think we can add anything here, because we'd confuse everyone. So let's just talk about the mascot, or maybe not.
Oh, yeah, we can do that. So, I got this.
Or the name itself.
Of Plan 9?
Plan 9.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So Plan 9, the name of the original distribution is called Plan 9 for Bell Labs, and that's a jab at this terrible movie called Plan 9 from Outer Space. And so the developers, the Unix guys at Bell Labs who were designing it, I don't know why they chose that specific movie to name their operating system after, but they did. Maybe because it was so bad, I don't know. But yeah, the story behind that is pretty simple. It's just Plan 9 from Outer Space. I think that movie is kind of regarded as like the worst movie ever created. Like ever. And so for some reason they named their operating system after that. And it's kind of ironic, in my opinion, because I think Plan 9 is like a work of art, really. You know, it's a flawless example of computer science principles, and it's a great implementation of specific concepts. But it's named after a terrible movie, you know, so it's just kind of funny, I guess. Glinda's the bunny, the mascot.
Glenn or Glenda. The movie also from the same scenarist as a Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, is it really? Oh, I didn't know that. I guess it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? But yeah, so Glinda's the bunny. Glinda was drawn by Rob Pike's wife, who also, I'm pretty sure, also designed the color scheme. I don't know like if he knows it very well, but the color scheme, I think Rob Pike commented on the color scheme a couple times, and they paid a lot of detail to the colors used. They're bright colors, you know, but they're also very kind of calm colors. There's not a lot of contrasting going on. Rio, used on a bitmap display, isn't 24-bit color. There's a photo, actually. If you go on the website, just go on the Plan 9 website, there's actually a photo, a screenshot of it at the desktop that shows the colors pretty well. But yeah, there's like hints of blue and hints of yellow. And so she designed the color scheme. She designed Glinda as well, the bunny rabbit.
Well, that's interesting to have the person who designed the mascot design also the color scheme for the operating system.
Yeah.
Actually, that's quite weird because you don't have the same flexibility for window managers on Plan 9. You're forced to have Rio because you don't have anything else.
Right.
Anyway, let's finish about Plan 9 on something more Unix-like. Eric Raymond has in his book like a section for Plan 9, and it's a book about Unix programming.
Yeah.
And he describes it, that the title of the chapter is Plan 9, The Way the Future Was. And the first sentence is, we know what Unix future used to look like. It was designed by the research group at Bell Labs that built Unix and called Plan 9 from Bell's lab. Plan 9 was an attempt to do Unix over again better. Mainly it was an attempt, but it's still an ongoing attempt, more or less. We don't know if it's going to take over one day, but other people are taking from Plan 9, that's right. For sure. So anything to add as an end note for Plan 9?
Yeah.
Just try it, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely give it a shot. Eric S. Ramond, I think he also had a comment about that. I think he said, when it came to Plan 9, Unix was just good enough. You know, even then it was just good enough. I think he said they were like...
Yeah, if you have a working system already running and it's good enough, why change it?
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, even if Plan 9 did stuff better, Unix was already there. And it was being, by then, it was used for about 20 years or so when Plan 9 came out. And I think something has to be said about that when people are developing new systems and new answers to questions in software. I think one of the worst things that could happen is... the current solution is just good enough for everyone else, and that would defeat the purpose of a new solution. But yeah, so even if Plan 9 didn't really take off the way it could have, like you said, we do see a lot of examples of it in current operating systems today.
That was a fairly long talk about Plan 9. Now, what's to take out of this talk and Unix related? Plan 9 is inspired by Unix, and it inspires Unix. Okay, so that's what is to remember out of this talk, the conclusion. Now let's move to chocolate milk. What's that? What? Wait, what, Adam? Why do you like it so much? Yeah, why do you like it so much?
Oh god, it's so tasty, man. I love chocolate. Actually, funnily enough, I can't stand white milk. I can't stand just regular milk. I taste even like the slightest bit and I get like sick for some reason, but chocolate milk, I could just drink that for the rest of my life and be fine. I don't know why I like it so much. I don't know. I mean, we kind of all have our favorite drink, and I guess I might like chocolate milk a bit more. As a matter of fact, I just picked up some more today at the grocery store and I was drinking some before we started this podcast. I don't know, man. All I do all day is to sit on the computer and drink chocolate milk.
I think someday there was Rock X and he posted that GIF image where someone pours all his chocolate milk into the sink, and you were like, "That's a torture."
Yeah. Oh man. He likes to talk about that. Yeah. And actually, whenever he draws a photo of me, because he's a great artist, and so every now and then I'll ask him to like just draw some kind of picture of me, and he always adds chocolate milk in it somewhere. Chocolate milk and Plan 9. He always adds chocolate milk and Plan 9 to it. But yeah.
He needs to do more of those.
Totally. Yeah.
So this is everything for this episode about Unicomp, Plan 9, and chocolate milk. And here are some info if you want to contact Adam/APK.
I'm starting to get back on the IRC server. I'm on it right now, actually. So I'll be on there, I think, more frequently now. I'm just APK on the IRC server. I do have an email address. I have this weird thing where I change it like every month or so. But my Gmail, which I use a lot and have used in the past, is Adam, my first name Adam, and then the Baron. So adamthebaron@gmail.com. So if you have any questions about Plan 9 or chocolate milk, hit me up, dude. I'll answer.
Or Unicomp.
Or Unicomp, yeah. Or anything in between. I love talking about email, so don't be scared.
So let's move to the section where we talk about what we did this week and last week. Let's start with a little review of last week. Last week podcast was about the booting process on Unix, and I dealt with the really generic overview of what happens at every level and why is it really related to Unix and why it's important to understand all those parts for debugging and the differences between all the newest Unix-like distributions. So that was it this week. What did I do this week? This week I didn't do much, so I don't think I'll spend too much time talking about that. Now, this was it. If you want to contribute, as usual, if you like what you're listening to, you can contribute in multiple ways. The first easy way is to just give your appreciation on IRC or on the forums extended podcast threads. It gives us a push to know we're going in the right direction. The second way to contribute is by adding some relevant information on those extended threads. A fourth way would be to help me fill the transcript on some episodes that are missing some. And the last way would be to join me on the podcast, and you can do that by asking for a podcast key on IRC or on the forums, and with that key you can log in to the user interface on podcast.nixers.net. And you, on this interface you set your available time for the next week, and then the best time, the best common time is chosen, and you can join at that time. And remember that you can find all the episodes on this little short link, podcast.nixers.net/what, W-H-A-T. Or you can check the feed URL that I just mentioned, podcast.nixers.net/F-E-E-D, podcast.nixers.net/feed. So this is it. Thank you very, very, very much for listening, and have a wonderful day. This was Venom for the Nixers podcast.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.